8:40, hereby call to order the House Committee on Environment and Land Use. We are open a public hearing on House Bill 2674. We have two people, and we'll have both come up, Stephen Cafori and Mitch Rose. Committee, we do intend to have a work session after the public hearing on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, good morning. My name is Stephen Cafori. I'm here this morning representing the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. American Planning Association is an organization of mostly land use planners. We represent folks who work with developers and people who work with local governments and state governments. So we have, as we say often, we represent both sides of the desk. When you come to turn in your plans, we have people who are asking for changes and people who are analyzing those requests. The one thing that you do have in common is we believe very strongly in the values of land use planning. There are a large number of bills. I didn't count exactly, but somewhere over 20 bills coming up in the next week and a half, 2 weeks in this committee. And we're not planning to get up and speak on every single one of those, Mr. Chair, so we will spare you that. But we did want to talk a little bit, some general comments about our views on land use planning and on these bills as a whole. I was president in 1973 in the legislature when we first passed Senate Bill 100, and I've watched with great interest over the years since then as we've developed our land use, established and developed our land use planning system, and the criticism and concerns that have been raised about the land use planning system. There's a general attitude that has pervaded a significant minority of this state, and I say minority because whenever it's been put to a ballot, yes, the land use planning system has prevailed, and that has been a number of times. But the minority attitude towards land use planning is that somehow it's a hindrance. It gets in the way of people doing what they want to do with their land. And it also inhibits societal goals. It inhibits growth, and it limits economic development. When the pioneers came here to Oregon and settled the land, they dug outhouses, dug wells, and used wood for their fuel. A person could, in those days, like the Indians who were here before them, live their life on their land and not really affect anybody else. That's not true anymore. We have many, many millions of people, and our numbers are growing every day. There's no way that whatever anybody does in this state does not impact someone else. What land use planning is a process for government working at representing all the people, trying to find how we can work out these conflicting uses. There's no way we can do it by just letting people do what they want to do, because that would inevitably impede someone else's ability to do what they want to do. There are two main values I want to talk about this morning of land use planning. One is, and you've heard these before, so I hope I'm not repetitious, but natural resource economy-based support. Oregon has both forestry and agriculture as main industries here in the state, and those industries we feel need, or the state feels, needs protection from competing uses. And I've heard, I'm sure you've heard a thousand friends talk a lot about the conflicting kinds of activities that go on in forestry areas or in farming areas with people who move into those areas for residential purposes that do not farm or cut trees, and but do inhibit those people who are there to farm and cut trees. The other concern has to do with the conservation of limited public resources. People who move outside of urban growth boundaries do not dig their own outhouses and dig their own wells anymore. They demand services. They demand sewer, water, electricity, natural gas, roads, fire protection, emergency medical services, all those services that are paid for by taxpayers and by ratepayers. People who live in cities pay for the services for those people who live in the country. It's a rural subsidy received by people who live in the country. Now, in some ways, our state has said that's a subsidy that we are willing, in fact, eager to pay if there are benefits coming back. If people are living out in the country and in their residential uses are providing services by operating farms or operating in the woods, they are providing part of the economy that benefits people who live in the cities. However, these people are living out there because they like it, then the reason, the effect of that is that they are asking people who live in the cities, the taxpayers and the ratepayers, to pay for their enjoyment of their living in the country. Now, that's not to say that nobody should ever live in the country. The only issue, the reason I'm raising this issue is we have to realize that there are costs and there are impacts. And what land use planning is attempting to do is to say that let's have a rational system whereby those impacts that people have because they live wherever they live can be managed in such a way that they are lessened on those people who live elsewhere. I'd like to introduce Mitch Rose, who is the president of the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association.
Thank you, Stephen. Good morning, Chair Girard, members of the committee. This is sort of an experiment for me. Rather than troop up here and testify on a series of land use bills, I'll just try to give you one piece of generic testimony that hopefully will pretty well establish our position on a number of the bills that you're going to be hearing today. What I propose to do is a couple of things. One is I'd like to just hand out a little piece that I've written here a couple of days ago. It's a single page front and back. It's called Why Oregon Plans. And, you know, you may have heard people exclaim sometimes, what were those planners thinking? This is the answer to that question. It's just the basics of why we have land use planning. I'm not going to talk about that today. I'll just hand it to you and hope that in the 3 minutes of spare time that you have during this legislative session, you may be able to take a look at it. With my oral comments today, what I would like to do is touch on 4 points that I think are related to many of the bills that you're going to be hearing this session that have to do with land use planning. The 4 points are these. First of all, good planning is good for our economy. You heard Stephen talk about that a little bit. I'll elaborate. Planning and economic development often are seen as competing forces. And we certainly would argue that they're not competing forces. They're complementary. And in fact, you cannot have a sound economy in the modern world without having some form of planning to protect a state or a community's resources, public services, and so on. And it isn't just planners who are making that claim. Economists say that too. And I think you've all received a copy of I think it's about an 80-page report that grew out of last session's House Bill 3557 on industrial lands. If you'll take a look at Chapter 2 of that report, pages 6 through 8 or 9, you'll see there quite a discussion about the relationship between planning and economic development, and it's a symbiotic relationship. Economists have covered that in a number of other places, too. There was an interesting study done by the Bank of America a number of years ago. I couldn't find the report this morning when I was preparing these notes, but I believe it was done in the early 1990s. The Bank of America looked at states throughout our nation and tried to establish whether there was some kind of a connection, a relationship between the health of the state's economy and the extent to which that state had measures like land use planning and environmental regulations and so on. And what they found was there was a very clear direct correlation. The states that had the healthiest economies also had the strongest programs for protecting their environment and their lands, their natural resources. The states that had the weakest economies tended to have the weakest laws regarding their resources and their lands. And there have been a number of people over the years that associated with economic development and the economy, not just planners, who recognized this and spoke out for it. Vicatilla, for example, Governor Vicatilla in his 1983 inaugural address, which incidentally was given in the middle of a deep recession, said, and I'm quoting here, "Land use planning is vital to our future. It is a blueprint for our growth as a state." A few years later, Neil Goldschmidt, former governor at the time he wrote this, in 1991 for Oregon Business Magazine, he wrote, "Land use planning is fundamental to our statewide economic health." A few years later, the Pendleton East Oregonian offered this editorial comment, "There is evidence on all sides that Oregon's economy has benefited from the planning process. We have been rewarded as a state and people by determining how our land will be used." And finally, perhaps the most compelling quote of all from that eminent statesman, John Chandler, he's in the room. He wrote in 1996 in an article on behalf of the Oregon building industry, "We see the land use planning system as a marketing incentive. We have faster processing time. We have more certainty in that we know what we can do. We have less need for government rigmarole than almost any place else in the country." The second point that I would offer to you this morning regarding many of these bills is that planning is a win-win process. I think all too often it's characterized as a win-lose process, where the winners are the folks who can do anything they want to do with their land, and the losers are the folks who can't do what they want to do with their land. And I would argue that that's a misperception, and that land use planning, if it's done properly, gives us all a very large return on the investment of a small regulatory burden. And you see an analogy to this, I think, almost every day if you travel on the interstate freeway. We have traffic laws there, of course, that limit people's speed to 65 miles an hour. Now that imposes a small burden, maybe a large burden, on many people. It's perhaps arbitrary. 62 miles an hour or 71 miles an hour might be a better number. You can argue that it is unfair because it imposes a greater burden on some than others. If you're a traveling salesman, for example, and you earn your livelihood from logging miles and visiting customers, speed limit may work a pretty big hardship on you. If you're just driving up to Portland to visit a friend, it's not much of a burden. And I would argue that the land use laws are very much the same by analogy. They do impose burdens and costs. If you look at any one law in isolation, it may seem arbitrary, and the laws may seem unfair to the extent that their burdens aren't distributed perfectly evenly. But the overall result for Oregon is a win-win situation. It rewards us with a high quality of life, more efficient public service systems, and a healthy economy and environment. And you've heard some examples of that in testimony to this committee earlier in this session. You heard some people testifying that while they were frustrated sometimes because the regulations wouldn't let them do exactly what they wanted to do with their land had, in fact, increased in value sometimes many times over. The third point I'd like to make this morning is that the state has vital interests in land use. Traditionally, in this country, planning has been a local matter because states delegated their legislative authority to local governments and said, "You do planning, cities and counties." And that worked okay for the first century of our nation's being. But in recent years, that hasn't worked very well. And I want to talk a little bit about this because I think sometimes it's real easy to see the local interest in land use, but it's a little harder to see the state's interest. I mean, if you see a shopping center or a subdivision go into a community, you can pretty quickly identify the effects on the economy and the streets and the neighborhoods and so forth. That's pretty obvious. The state's interest in such development may not be real clear. What are the state's interests in land use? Well, the obvious answer to that, the one that comes to the lips of people most often, is protecting natural resources like the coastal beaches or wild and scenic rivers. But the state's interests that I would like to focus on today are the economic interests in land use. Local land use and development strongly affects state interests because of the state's huge investment in public facilities and services like highways, sewers, water systems, and so on. And two of the best examples I know of can be seen in Deschutes County. In Bend, a new parkway was built there a few years ago to handle that city's terrible terrible traffic problems. And that new bypass cost about $100 million. And most of that was paid for by state and federal funds. And much of the need for that facility came, arguably, from the patterns of growth and development that had occurred for five or six decades preceding the construction of that highway. In other words, land use was a major contributing factor to the need for that highway. And meanwhile, down in the southern part of Deschutes County, a large group of local governments and state and federal agencies have spent several years and millions of dollars there trying to resolve land use issues in the Lapine area. Sprawling rural subdivisions approved several decades ago have left a legacy of problems with groundwater, sanitation, traffic, and the threat of wildfires. And I hasten to add that I'm not picking on Bend or Deschutes County here. I could find examples similar to this in probably almost every county in Oregon. And Bend and County have fine planning programs today, so I'm not saying they don't do a good job of planning today. But I am saying that one of the reasons they do that is that 30 years ago, our state asserted its interests in land use by creating a statewide program for planning.
Mr. Rose?
Yes.
I'm sorry, we have seven bills scheduled to hear today, so I'm going to ask you if you could quickly bring your commentary to a close.
I'll certainly do that, Mr. Chair. Last point I would make is simply that our planning system relies on the local plan. It's often seen as a state planning program, but I want to emphasize that where the state doesn't do any planning or zoning, doesn't issue any permits, it's done locally. And it's a partnership, therefore, that represents both state and local interests in the issues I've discussed. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I have a question and a comment.
Representative Richard.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Rose, you're indicating that a correlation between strong land use planning and a strong, vibrant economy, and also the need for Oregon to retain such a strong land use planning, and yet our economy is one of the worst in the nation and has the highest unemployment. So I'm a little concerned about the correlation that you're trying to bring there.
Chair Gerard, Representative Richardson, we don't disagree for a moment that the economy is in bad shape. We certainly would disagree that that's attributable to land use planning. I mean, we've just gone through a decade of some of the most rapid economic growth and development in the state's history. So, we had a statewide planning program during that time. My understanding of our economic problems is that they're very much related to national and even international trends and forces that have very little to do with land use. And I want to hasten to add that that doesn't mean that I'm saying do nothing to ever change the planning program. I think there are significant things that could be done to enhance our planning program, and one of them is to deal with the issue of industrial lands and the adequacy of the supply. I think we do have a problem in many communities, not so much with the quantity, with the amount of land they have, but just they don't have very good land zoned for industrial use, and they don't have the services and facilities necessary for new industry.
Can I follow up?
Follow?
Just by way of follow-up, as we receive testimony from local government leaders and economic development leaders in rural counties, their perception is a little bit different than what your two might be. For instance, they would not see urban Oregon as subsidizing rural. They kind of think, well, who paid for light rail and we're paying taxes too, and those kinds of things. It kind of goes both ways. And they keep pointing to the reality that many of the counties have double-digit unemployment, and their concern is that originally land use from Senate Bill 100 was aimed at assuring that rural jobs did not accelerate too greatly because it could affect rural Oregon. But now that we're 30 years later, it hasn't been a problem of having too many jobs rurally, but it's insufficient number of jobs, and so that's why they're asking for relief so that there can be greater economic development. And certainly there has to be this balance, and that's what we're called upon to make the decision about.
Mr. Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson. I certainly wouldn't argue that cities, as a general matter, subsidize rural areas. I think there are cases where the extension of urban services into rural areas really does work a hardship on urban communities for serving sprawling rural developments. But I don't argue that there's a general pattern of the cities subsidizing the county, the rural areas.
Chairman, ask a brief question.
Representative Greenlick.
You signed up to testify in 2674. I agree with your general principles. And 2674 seems like an innocuous expansion of land use. How do those principles apply, and what's your position on 2674?
I have no position on 2674, and as I say, I'm simply offering some general testimony this morning rather than troop up here on each of the bills. And I thought that might be more convenient for you also, so you wouldn't have to see us up here on every one of them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, we're going to be opposing all the bills. We're not going to be testifying on every single one. But what we've seen since 1973 is that every year, or every other year when legislature comes, bit by bit by bit by bit, attempts to erode the land use plan. Well, let's just do this little exemption. Well, let's just change this little one. If you look in the statutes at the uses now that are allowed in farm use zones, for example, it's, I don't know the number, but it's humongous, and it didn't get there in one session. It'd be, well, what if I just had this little tweak, and what if I just had this little tweak until, if continued unchecked, there would be no such thing as an agricultural zone left anymore, because all the uses that are allowed anywhere else would be allowed there. That's the problem with fighting these bills one at a time and saying, well, this is really won't harm anybody because it's this little tweak here, and this really won't do any difficulty because it's only this little thing here. We're opposing all the bills with the exception of the one bill. We don't say that land use planning is perfect and can't be improved, and there is a bill in establishing a task force to review land use planning. We think that something is done on a systematic basis and saying let's come back and review where are we doing well, where are there improvements necessary in the system. That makes sense, but by piecemealing the system to death as these bills do, we oppose them.
Yeah, if we maintain that status, we'd still have kingdoms in this country. We'd never have any changes.
Mr. Chair, we may have sent you a mixed message here, and I want to make sure we're getting our story straight. I don't think that Oregon APA opposes every land use bill that is coming before you this session. I think our position is that we, as Stephen has said, is that we have a general concern about the number of bills that make piecemeal modifications to the program. We think modifications to the program are appropriate in some places, and we're very supportive of some of the ideas that have been proposed. So we're not saying we're opposed to all land use legislation for the entire session.
Mr. Chair, we are working, for example, on the mill siting bill as part of a work group to make that bill helpful. It will provide some economic development for our rural communities. But the bills that are coming before you that we looked at in this little clump coming along, we have problems.
Thank you for both your testimony.
Thank you.
That concludes the list of those that signed up to speak on House Bill 2674. Is there any other person who would like to testify on House Bill 2674? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on 2674 and open a work session on House Bill 2674. Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2674 be moved out of committee with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Richardson moves House Bill 2674 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Representative Doyle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll support this bill. And I guess probably based on what Representative Greenlick had described it earlier as fairly innocuous. However, I do share the concerns of the two who just testified as far as, having a number of bills come before us that, do just kind of nibble at the edges without knowing, what the plan is. If we are going forward with a lot of minor changes to land use when, in fact, we ought to be more focused, in my opinion, on, some some major revisions to land use. We're basically going to end the session without any type of coherent message, I think, to the public. And my concern here, as it will be in a few of the others that we'll be seeing over the next few weeks, is that we are just trying to manage by exception. We're trying to become the local planning agencies, and we're not setting a vision. And like I say, this one is fairly innocuous. I don't mind voting for it, but I see we're heading down a path that's just going to lead us into more disarray than I think where we are right now.
For the committee's benefit, I believe the administrator can correct me, but I think we have something close to 140?
Yes, Mr. Chair, 142.
We have presently 142 bills in front of this committee, of which we have to make the decision by April 11th as to which bills this committee will consider, as far as House bills are concerned, during the next 2 months, because this committee is at this point scheduled to conclude its hearings toward the end of May. So it is, and in the last week we've had something like 50 bills. Representative Doyle brings up a very good point, and it's been very, very difficult up to this point to try to coordinate just exactly which bills are going in which directions, which ones are of the more significant kind that we can concentrate on. So it's kind of like waiting for all of them to come in before we can devise that plan. But I would concur with your observations in that respect, and this committee will endeavor to do whatever it can as it expedites. As an example, we have 7 bills today to be heard. That's a lot in 2 hours. We're going to be asking folks, there doesn't seem to be a simple bill in front of us. Every one of them is involved and can take hours of testimony. So it's difficult. We're going to try and ask those that are neutral on bills, if they have a written statement, to submit the written statement, but to skip by the oral portion of it so that we can move through some of these bills and find a... some of these bills are obviously those that we, at this point, feel we want to see move on, because they are, this bill in particular doesn't seem to offend anyone, but Mr. Ackerman still has to speak, so Representative Ackerman?
No, I just want to say that Representative Doyle makes a good point, particularly for those of us that don't do yet land use every day. Sometimes I think we're either chipping around the edges or doing a patchwork job on a quilt. However, I will note that today we will have a public hearing on House Bill 2912, which establishes an Oregon Commission on Land Use Reform, which would study the strengths and weaknesses of Oregon land use and develop a list of recommended changes. This may be a long-range vehicle for us to look at, and it may be a better policy of the committee to defer some work on some bills and let the Commission on Land Use Reform take up some of that slack.
Is there any further Representative Roosevelt?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a comment specifically on this bill, House Bill 2674. My concern, I will be voting for it, but because I don't think a compelling case has been made for why it would be a problem, but my concern about this bill is no one really came forward at our first hearing and made a case for why we need to change this this 5,000 or this 10-mile rule for smaller communities. And I would have felt more comfortable if somebody who had a property that they wanted to develop it as a guest ranch and couldn't because of the current language had at least appeared here and told us that there was a problem we needed to fix. But having said that, I haven't heard that this will create huge problems either. But in general, I think people who want to see the law change should give us some reason why we need to do it. So,
a valid comment, Representative. Seeing no further discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
Aye.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Donner.
Aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Berard.
Aye. Do we have a volunteer to be a carrier, or should we put this on the consent calendar? The committee votes we will send House Bill 2674 to the consent calendar with a due pass recommendation. And we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2674 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2755. The bill's sponsor, Representative Tootie Smith, is out today with a sick daughter. Do we have anyone that would like to testify on this bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we have a list of people that would like to testify on this bill.
Okay. Okay, will you read the bill, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2755 eliminates minimum lot size requirements for primary or accessory dwellings customarily provided in conjunction with farm use that are allowed as an outright use in exclusive farm use zones. It prohibits the Land Conservation and Development Commission from adopting or applying administrative rules to implement statutory provisions allowing primary or secondary, or excuse me, not secondary, accessory dwellings customarily provided in conjunction with farm use as outright permitted use in exclusive farm use zones, and it requires the Commission to repeal administrative rules implementing such statutory provisions not later than July 1st, 2004. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Of course, as soon as I make the announcement that if you're neutral on a bill, we won't take any oral testimony, there's nobody neutral on this bill. So
much for good intentions.
So much for that idea. Right. So we will begin. We do want to we have 10 people signed up. We're going to try and have this bill heard to a point by around the half-hour mark. And then we need to address House Bill 3176. So we'll limit the testimony to 3 minutes for each individual. And I'll go begin with Cliff Kanege. Mr. Administrator, will you watch the clock?
Of course.
We'll try to give you a warning when after you're at the two-minute warning. That's good.
Okay. And I am not neutral.
But there are no three-pointers here. So.
I am Cliff Kanege, a recently retired farmer from Benton County. I speak in opposition to this bill. Today I'm taking an easy way out. I'm reading a relevant letter that was in the March 7 Capital Press. To the editor. The February 21 article titled "Bill Would Expand Property Rights on Farmland" quotes David Hunnicutt as testifying that it doesn't address the real issue, which is, why do we have an income standard in the first place that 80% of the farmers in Oregon can't meet? Mr. Hunnicutt's 80% is probably correct, providing he includes hobby farmers. The 97 Census of Agriculture indicates that 62% of Oregon farms gross less than $10,000, have an average gross of $2,700, an average net loss of $3,200, and an overall loss of $67.4 million. If another 18% are operating in the red just above the $10,000 threshold, that would be 80% of Oregon farmers being incapable of meeting the $80,000 income standard. The 97 census also indicates that the other 38% of Oregon farms gross over $10,000 have an average gross of $223,000, an average net income of $63,000, and an overall net profit of $825 million. These production farmers exceed the $80,000 income standard by 280%. Mr. Hunnicutt asks, why do we have an income standard that 80% of the farmers in Oregon can't meet? The answer is to screen out the hobby farmers. After all, there is 752,000 acres of exception areas in Oregon zoned rural residential as a place for hobby farmers to exercise their hobby.
1 minute for writing this.
Thank you. End of letter, which, by the way, was written by me. The chart on the back side. This chart tells the same story in graphic form. My question is, which group of farmers do we want our grandchildren to depend on for food? The committed family production farmers on the left side of the chart who exceed the $80,000 gross income standard by 280%, or the hobby farmers on the right who can only gross $2,700 while going in the hole $3,200. The $80,000 standard is not the problem. The problem is an educational one. Many people do not know what a farmer is, nor what he does. Please kill this bill so we can apply ourselves to doing what needs to be done. Thank you. Any questions?
You haven't any time left for questions, but thank you very much, Mr. Bill. Mark Tipperman.
Thank you, members of the committee and chair. My name is Mark Tipperman. My wife and I, through our family-owned limited liability company, own a 2,500-acre cattle and timber ranch in Union County. We're here in Oregon because of land use planning, because it's possible, at least historically, to buy a large place that's affordable for production. Competition between farmers and ranchers and those who are buying property for single-family homes and development makes further acquisition of farm and other agricultural production land unfeasible economically. Furthermore, conflicts that are inherent between single-family residences and hobby farmers and real farmers and forest owners are well known, include numerous trespasses, problems over application of pesticides and herbicides, conflicts over water use, problems with dogs harassing livestock, and the like. We cannot maintain an agricultural base without a density of agricultural uses. Agricultural uses require specialized equipment, which has to be bought on a custom farm basis, requires places like tractor dealers and other farm implement operators that need a large base of farmers in order to stay in business, require a large group of farmers to provide the bulk to maintain food processing plants and business that give value-added benefits to our agricultural community. I concur wholly with the general perception that over the last couple of decades, and certainly every legislative session that I've been attending over the last 10 or so years, there's been an ongoing effort to whittle away at protection, the exclusive farm use zones, and those effects have been significant and adverse to farmers throughout the state. You can see the problems even in a rural area like Wallowa County, where now agricultural land is at such a premium because of the competition between farmers and single-family owners that acquisition of agricultural land in that county for agricultural purposes is no longer feasible. And with the recent legislation that now allows virtually every agricultural parcel be divided into at least two non-farm dwelling sites, and a legislation before you or coming up before you shortly that would enhance that, this makes the problem even more severe. So in sum, I would just ask that you turn away efforts to further weaken protection for exclusive farm use zones and leave exclusive farm use zones for farmers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Timmerman. Committee members, we have a lot of bills on this particular subject, and this is probably the last time I will subject you to a lot of testimony in regards to this issue, but I do feel it's a major issue that we're looking at in this particular session. Kerry McLaren.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chair Gerard, members of the committee. My name is Carrie McLaren. I'm a staff attorney for 1000 Friends of Oregon. I'm speaking here today in opposition to House Bill 2755. I will in the future when I testify, Chair, write my name more clearly so you don't have to question your administrator who I am. The reason why we're opposing this bill is because we think that the gross income standards and the administrative rules that have been passed by the Land Conservation and Development Commission have been a critical tool to preserve Oregon's agricultural lands for farm use and not allow them to be lost to rural sprawl, hobby farms, and ranchettes. It's important to look at what the current law allows and see what this law changes. Current law allows primary or accessory dwellings customarily provided in conjunction with farm use. This includes primary farm dwellings as well as any dwellings for farm help for seasonal or year-round farm worker labor. What this bill would do is both require LCDC to repeal its current administrative rules and prohibit LCDC from adopting any rules in the future. This takes out what people are frequently looking for in land use planning, which is some clarity in terms of what the laws actually provide. I will note, as I have before in another income standard bill, that the farm income test does not apply to other types of dwellings, such as lot of record dwellings, non-farm dwellings, which may be approved in EFU zones. All told, there are 7 different types of dwellings that can be built in an exclusive farm use zone. We're simply asking that this provision for farm dwellings be retained for farmers. I have on my second page just some more detail about what the Land Conservation and Development Commission's rules have meant. I want to bring your attention to the bottom of page 2 where I've diagrammed the percent of gross farm sales by farm class. The farms grossing $100,000 or more, farms which by all stretch would meet any of the farm income standards under this rule, produce more than 88% of Oregon's agricultural products. That's the heart of our agricultural industry. That's what we're seeking to be able to maintain in our land use planning program and why it is important for the reasons that the gentleman before me spoke to not lose our agricultural land base as a result of conflicts from residential development. I think it's very important that the committee understand that there's no shortage of houses in EFU zones. For example, in Jackson and Yamhill counties, there are at least 6 houses for every farm that grosses more than $10,000 per year. In Hood River County, there is a house for every 12-acre zoned exclusive farm use. In that county, the average farm size is 75 acres. So what we are getting is a lot of development in our EFU zones, which does not support and, in fact, does hinder our agricultural economy.
Your time is up, ma'am. Thank you very much. We're not having any time left for questions, obviously, but let's bring up Glenn Stoneberg. You're on the clock, Glenn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Glenn Stonebrink, and I'm here to testify on my own behalf and not representing any organization or special interest group. I do believe, however, that my views represent a large growing group of Oregonians who believe in private property rights and seek a larger degree of quality of life. I support House Bill 2755 as a step in the right direction to stop the political trickery that has been slammed on the backs of honest Oregonian landowners. It has never been proven that minimum lot size has any credibility towards whether or not a farm parcel is a viable farm unit. The $80,000 rule is arbitrary and thus ridiculous, and even the proponents stutter and stammer when they try to explain its logic. Land use planning in Oregon has not stopped high-value farmland from being developed. Rather, it has only slowed the process so urban growth boundary land investors can reap the big profits as farmland enters the urban growth zones. In other words, farmers cannot sell their land for their convenience, their profit, or to dispose of unfavorable lands suitable for other uses, or to keep the bankruptcies away from their doors. Farmers can only farm lands deemed by the state government to be exclusive farm use, regardless if the land is farmable and regardless if they're going broke. Our state land use system has not accomplished its design goals. It has served certain special interest groups, political, and oftentimes greedy agendas quite well. It has not preserved farmland for farmers. The system is broken. 2755 will not fix everything that's broken in land use, but it restores a little common sense into the process of planning for the future and restricts unelected bureaucrats from tearing apart dreams and hopes of Oregonians who bought property with plans for the future. And I didn't bring an amendment, but just in reading the bill, I noticed that the effective date for the LCDC to repeal administrative rules on page 19 doesn't go into effect until July 1st, 2004. Perhaps before this bill comes back, I'd like to see that 2003. I can't find logic why it would, if it were to pass, why it would have to wait until 2004.
We intend to have a further public hearing on this bill when Representative Smith is available to perhaps answer that question.
If there's any time left, I'll have to answer any
question. No questions. Let's bring up a panel this time. Don Schellenberg, Peter Kanegi, and Peter Hanley. You're all against this bill, so... You're on the clock, Don.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau here today in opposition, as you said. The Oregon Farm Bureau has worked hard over the years to find the right mix of qualifications for siting farm dwellings. As I recounted for you earlier this session in testimony on House Bill 2639, we made significant changes and gains in administrative rules during the interim to aggregate income from the farming operation, to allow for more than one primary dwelling for a farm operation, and removed indexing of the gross income qualification. By statute change, we clarified that lending institutions can secure a loan for a relative dwelling and made it possible to site accessory seasonal farm worker dwellings under the same conditions as all other accessory farm dwellings. Proposed changes in this bill would erase all of those gains we made in administrative rules and undermine the statutory changes. The purpose of the statute and the correlating administrative rules is to provide that new dwellings sited in the farm zone are for residents that are engaged in farm activities. If that were not the legislative intent, the statute would have simply said dwellings and not provided any further conditions. The reason the language limiting the new farm dwellings is important is that each time an initial primary dwelling is placed on a parcel, that parcel generally ceases to be available for purchase by other producers who need or want to expand their farm operations. Producers cannot afford to be laying out extra capital for improvements that are not necessary to their operation. A second problem with House Bill 2755 is the repealing of the minimum lot size requirements. Repealing the minimum lot size only makes things worse by allowing the siting of a primary dwelling on a small parcel. Such actions almost ensures that the dwelling will eventually be a non-farm dwelling.
1 minute, Don.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm about to conclude. You may also recall Mr. Kanegi's testimony on House Bill 2639, in which he cited 14 examples of conflicts because of non-farm dwellings located near or adjacent to his property. In the last 2 days, I've had one phone call from a non-farm dwelling complaining about the farming practices of a neighboring farmer, and a call from a farmer who is being harassed by a non-farm neighbor. That points up the need to keep the bill and keep the laws that we have today. The Oregon Farm Bureau respectfully requests that the committee not send out House Bill 2755. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Don. Peter?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Kanegi, and I farm in North Albany. House Bill 2755 is an attack on farmers. It's an attack on Oregon's agrarian landscape. It's an attack on the environment, but most of all, it's an attack on the future livability and sustainability of future generations of Oregonians. One only has to travel into the Skagit Valley of Washington or Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, or any of many other prime agricultural areas that have been severely degraded by unrestricted housing development in farm areas to realize the importance of Oregon's Senate Bill 100 for the future generations of Oregon. Without Senate Bill 100, I likely would not be farming where I am farming today. House Bill 2755 and most of the other land use bills before you this session are outright attacks on Oregon's land use planning system by a group of people who have only their own short-term desires and greed in mind and don't give a rat's ass about the environment, sustainability, or future generations of Oregon. Farmland protection in Oregon needs increased, not eroded. This committee needs to send a message to Oregonians that it cares about Oregon's livability, its environment, and future generations, and dump all these bills attacking land use planning into the trash where they belong. Thank you.
Thank you. Peter?
Chair, His Honor, members of the committee, my name is Peter Hanley, Executive Director of CASA of Oregon, based in Newburgh, Oregon. We develop housing on behalf of farm workers around the state of Oregon. And in the interim session 1999-2001, I served on a farm worker housing task force that came up with many recommendations. One of them was to help siting of farm worker housing. Last session, a bill was passed, HB 2171, which effectively eliminated seasonal farm worker housing as an outright use in agricultural areas, and in its place made definitions for accessory dwellings, which included housing for farm workers. With this bill, farm workers would be completely eliminated from the accessory dwelling statute. We oppose this bill, and last session we had a number of folks that came together to work on behalf of Oregon's farm workers and housing for them. And those groups included the Association of Oregon Cities, the Association of Oregon Counties, League of Cities, Thousand Friends of Oregon, and others. And we're opposed to this, and thank you for the testimony.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you, gentlemen. And Lynn Parton.
Chair's Honor, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lynn Parton, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. I'm the Farm Worker Program's representative, among other things. In the interest of brevity, I'll refer you to my written comments. Peter Hanley also stole some of my thunder on the work group from 3171. I would just submit to you that we are very concerned about the probably unintended consequence in this bill of injuring our ability to help, and other people like Peter Hanley, to help provide much-needed farm worker housing across the state. The work group was, I am not going to come here and try to pawn myself off to you as a land use expert, but there were, as President Courtney would say, a lot of certified smart people in this area involved in this work group, and there were draft after draft after draft, and what emerged as House Bill 3171 was definitely a compromise. This would dismantle it piecemeal and injure the ability of people to provide housing for farm workers. You know how important agriculture is to this state and how important farm workers are to that industry, and I would urge you, please, to vote this bill down. Thank you.
Representative Richards.
Mr. Chair, it's Parton?
Is that Parton, right? Yes.
This is, you're focusing on an area that I hadn't thought about before, and so I'd like to spend just a moment on this. What Peter Hanley said was that the bill would remove from workers, seasonal workers, from the definition of accessory dwellings. Is that?
Yes, that's kind of a separate issue. What this does, if you look at my written testimony, our concern is it takes out the primary or accessory dwellings, and that would hurt the ability to place on-farm farm worker housing, which the work group had worked hard to be able to do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And our final testimony is Ron Eber.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Ron Eber, Farm and Forest Land Specialist for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. To be brief, I'm simply providing you with some testimony and concerns about the bill, some material I presented before that I would point out there are a number of ways to get dwellings in farm zones. There's a chart attached to the testimony that shows the large number of dwellings that have been approved each year since 1993, from primary farm dwellings to non-farm dwellings. Also, noting that this bill, in removing the commission's rule, does two things. One, it takes out the standards providing for the primary farm dwelling, takes us back to a statutory standard that led to a large number of dwellings in farm zones where people simply were not farming or earning any commercial scale income for farming. Second, as you've heard, I think it's an unintended consequence, but the bill also takes out the statutory requirement that we adopt rules that came out of last session dealing with farm worker housing for accessory farm dwellings. There used to be a provision in the farm zone that explicitly allowed for seasonal farm worker housing. The commission also had rules for accessory farm dwellings that applied to year-round farm and ranch hands. It was deemed last time by the work group that was referred to that led to House Bill 3171 that having those separate provisions stigmatized seasonal farm worker housing, and there really was no reason to distinguish between those two groups of folks. So the direction was to roll those together. The commission developed rules this last year which had broad support from the farm community, the farm worker community, 1,000 friends, and the counties, and we've developed those rules, and if this bill goes forward, we would have to repeal them. That again takes us back to a general standard that simply says dwellings, plural, customarily provided in conjunction with farm use. That was the statutory provision that jurisdictions used prior to the addition of seasonal farm worker housing to the statute to authorize those dwellings, but it would provide no guidance. It would leave a lot of room for debate and litigation, which was the case prior to seasonal farm worker housing being added to the statute. So we had a general standard. We got a little bit more specific. We went to more specific rules from last session, and this would take us all the way back to square one. So with that, we have concerns and do not support this bill as drafted.
Thank you, Mr. Eber.
Sir.
That concludes our... Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Rosenbaum.
Next time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go right ahead.
Ron, I, along with the Representative Zahner, co-chaired that work group last session that came up with the language that you're talking about, and certainly you're right. It did come through a great deal of negotiation, so I don't want to see it change. But what I want to ask you about is, what is the effect of the changes that are made a couple of places in this bill, first at the bottom of page one by deleting the language on lines 27 and 28, and then adding language that says that LCDC may not adopt or apply an administrative rule to implement this paragraph. It seems very odd to leave language in the statute that, as you just testified, is ambiguous and open to a lot of interpretation, and then not allow rulemaking to clarify how it's to be interpreted. What do you think the effect of that would be?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, well, by removing our rule, requiring us to repeal our rules and not allow any rules, we would take us to a situation where each county would develop its own standards and apply them case by case. What we found previously is that leaves those decisions open to a lot of debate, a lot of appeals, and eventually it leads to a lot of dwellings not in conjunction with farm use that end up being approved in farm zones that create the conflicts and undermine the farmland base.
So follow up, Mr. Chair. So is it your testimony then that LCDC would basically have no role to play in that process that you just laid out?
Chair Garrard, Representative Rosenbaum, as I read this, we would not be able to adopt any rule to implement this paragraph regarding dwellings in conjunction with farmings.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Eber. We're going to conclude the public hearing on House Bill 2755 and open a work session on House Bill 3176. We have no amendments to this bill, and the chair would look for a motion.
3176.
3176.
That's the one we didn't. Mr. Chair, just a question. A number of us didn't see that the agenda had this bill added, and so we didn't bring our bill files down. Can perhaps staff refresh our memory about what testimony there was on this bill at our public hearing?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum. My notes say the only testimony we received was from John Chandler and Tom Gallagher.
I have addition. Also from Wayne Scott.
Yes, and from Representative Scott. I don't have my other notes with me. We do have Mr. Chandler in the room who would probably be better to address that at this point than I.
Representative Richardson, do you have any notes regarding Representative Scott?
Yes, Representative Scott testified that OECD would be involved here to develop guidelines because of the need and supply for industrial and commercial lands. And then Representative Ackerman asked the question, why would we want OECD dictating to local cities in this regard? And the answer that was given was to speed the process because it's not working in its current configuration.
And was Chandler Gallagher opposed?
Representative Rosenbaum, would you like Mr. Chandler to come forward?
I guess if he wishes to reprise his comments from the other day, that might be helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, John Chandler here on House Bill 3176. I won't be doing a reprise of the comments necessarily, Representative Rosenbaum. I do, as I understand from talking to Representative Scott and some other folks about this bill, the content that Representative Scott is trying to get, the idea here, is already being worked in the Senate. In Senate Bill 467, we've had a hearing over there on essentially the same exact topic. 467 has, it will be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. I think what Representative Scott was hoping to have happen with this bill is to move it from this committee down to Ways and Means so that the two can be worked in concert there with amendments as necessary or not, depending on how that plays out. If that's of any use for your deliberations.
And John, my understanding is there's a work group that's meeting to try to come up with a set of recommendations that are adopted by consensus on how to deal with the industrial land supply issue. And I had asked Representative Scott if he was part of that discussion. He told me he was not. But is that generally the subject of that work group, the subject of this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, yes. There is a work group. Representative Scott has not been involved in it all, but he or any of the rest of you are more than welcome to participate if you have time. It's got a broad representation, and so Senate bills, I won't take up too much of your time here, but we have state agencies, the governor's office, the interest groups, and we've been working with the Representative Knope's office and with Senator Brown's office, and your chair here and others to be sure that people are aware roughly, and I apologize that we haven't been as gotten around as much as we could. The bill that Representative Scott brought forward could have been written by, in part, that work group. I mean, it's the same topic. The conversation I had with him yesterday was basically that by the time this bill moved out of the House, the Senate bill would be over here, and the Senate would have already dealt with the issue. That didn't seem like a good... It seemed kind of redundant, frankly. The Ways and Means process is where that a lot of it's going to happen because of the funding issue of the Senate bill, which I will tell you about when it gets here, obviously, isn't going to go very far if we don't have funding for the agencies to do the work involved. So having Governor Scott's bill in the Ways and Means Committee makes sense in that broader context.
And this bill does have a referral to Ways and Means. So
could we move it to Ways and Means with no recommendation?
That's certainly during the discussion portion. Once we have a motion to discuss it, we can discuss it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Could I move a point of work session, right?
Yes.
Can I move 3176 to Ways and Means with no recommendation?
Representative Greenlick moves House Bill 3176 to Ways and Means with no recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Doyle.
Thank you, Chair. I guess I disagree with the having no recommendation. I think it is a good bill, something that deserves further consideration. And when you say no recommendation from this committee, then the likelihood of its success diminishes. And I would rather we pass it out with a due pass recommendation.
Any further discussion? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I support the motion because my concern, and I think it relates back to a discussion we had on our previous couple of bills, is that we're dealing with some pretty complicated areas of the law, and clearly this is a problem that there's been broad consensus needs to be dealt with. What I wouldn't want to see happen, though, is bills moving forward as individual bills that don't fit with some overall package of recommendations that were adopted by all the stakeholders. And so, to me, to send it without recommendation isn't a lack of support. It's simply saying we want it to fit as a piece with what's going on the Senate side, and we want to see, you know, a really well-integrated package of recommendations that everybody supports, which I think is where things are heading. So that is why I support it.
Any further discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Greenlund.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
No.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Girard.
No. The measure passes. House Bill 3176 is referred to Ways and Means. Well, I'm sorry, did you... You did make it referred to Ways and Means with no recommendation. Okay, we will open a public hearing on House Bill. We'll close the work session on 3176 and open the work session on House Bill 2860. Mr. Administrator.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2860 modifies standards local governments must consider when adopting exceptions to land use planning goals. It limits the rulemaking authority of the Land Conservation and Development Commission related to the standards.
You open the works. And I want to correct myself if I said work session. I meant a public hearing on 2860. Okay. At approximately 10 o'clock, we have some folks coming in to testify on House Bill 3175. So we're going to hear testimony on 2860 until approximately 10 o'clock, and then we'll abbreviate that public hearing and go to 3175. So, but let's resume on 2860. Dave Riley.
Good morning, Chair Girard, distinguished members of the committee. I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 2860. I'm not here representing any land use group or property rights groups. I'm a businessman from Hood River County. Currently, the law for the reasons exceptions requires a business to prove that there is not another site that does not require an exception but can accommodate the same use. The problem with that is that if a business is requesting an exception, it is on a site-specific basis. A business may not own or control the other site, so the alternate site is in many cases not an option, which effectively kills the economic opportunity and project in many cases. More than adequate safeguards still exist in the reasons exceptions process if this bill were to pass, including the compatibility analysis and the EC analysis, which is the long-term environmental, economic, social, and energy consequences analysis, which will still have to be evaluated by the local government. The benefit of supporting House Bill 2860 is that it would allow businesses to present opportunities to local government for reasonable consideration. And it allows local government to consider these projects and opportunities on their own merits. It doesn't mean that the safeguards are gone. It merely allows local government the opportunity to consider good projects. For these reasons, I urge you to support House Bill 2860, and I'd like to answer any questions that you might have at this time.
Any questions of Mr. Riley? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Don Schellenberg. And I might as well bring up Glenn Stonebrink and Harlan Levy, all as part of the panel. I don't see Harlan here. Dave Honeycutt. Dave, would you like to come up with this group?
Morning, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. And I'll preface my comments. The previous speaker, we're only talking about inside the urban growth boundary, then I don't have a big issue. But the problem with the language, as I read it, is that it applies everywhere. The concept of land use planning is to identify land-related resources and amenities that, for one reason or another, should be protected. Oregon has done that through the adoption of administrative rules called goals. Within those goals, certain uses are prohibited because they are allowed outright in another goal and would generally present a conflict with the primary use if allowed in a different goal. For example, commercial uses are not allowed in a farm zone because they are an outright use in a commercial zone inside the UGB, and because the volume of automobile traffic in a farm zone would conflict with the safety and ability of the producers to move their equipment, inputs, and produce to and from the fields. On the other hand, if there were a need for a certain commercial activity for the urban and perhaps even the rural community that in the commercial owner's opinion could not be located inside the UGB, the owner could apply for an exception to the prohibition to site the commercial activity in the farm zone. The exception process then requires that the owner conduct a formal alternatives analysis showing why the commercial activity cannot be located inside the urban growth boundary but must be sited in the farm zone. Having proved the point, the exception is granted. The effect of House Bill 2860 is to set aside the formal alternative analysis and allow the activity where the owner chooses, in spite of the fact that the activity could be located in an area where conflict would not arise. The proposed change in House Bill 2860 violates the basic principles of taking an exception, or said another way, giving special permission only when there is no other choice. The Oregon Farm Bureau respectfully requests the committee reject passage of House Bill 2860. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. Go ahead.
My name is Glenn Stonebrink, speaking only for myself. Support the bill. Previous testimony said this bill would allow counties to decide. And that, first, people who object to that seem like that's a bad thing, that counties can decide what really happens with the residents and the lands within the county, because they're elected officials. And yet, you just heard testimony that the goals that are put together by LCDC, those are done in rule. Those are not done in law. And I think we're beginning to see some of your frustration, but the answer why your frustration is there is that the laws have not been specific, and yet there have been abuses to the intent of the law that started out 30 years ago, that have taken this astray, which is actually where the problems have arisen. So when you see the tweaking that are coming bit by bit, law by law, it's because it's gone astray. The goals are not what the legislature has written in law, but what somebody interprets. And so that's why we're here. At least that's why I'm here, and I didn't write these bills, but I see them as just, again, steps in the right direction to correct things in statute that are gone astray within the goals and the movement.
Mr. Honeycutt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of 2860. And let me give you a little bit of background on this particular piece of legislation, which might help you in understanding what it's trying to do. I don't know if anybody has explained to the committee the exceptions process before, but right now in Oregon land use law, there is an exceptions process. It's statutorily, it's contained in the statute that you're, that we're trying to amend with this bill. There are also myriad provisions in the Oregon administrative rules and LCDC's administrative rules that deal with the exceptions criteria. So you look at these statutory criteria and think it's a relatively short statute. Believe me, the statute is fleshed out in the administrative rules in mind-numbing detail, and so it goes far beyond what the statute requires. But essentially what you're talking about with an exception is the idea that typically on a quasi-judicial basis, a landowner will come in and say, look, I agree, and let's use, since we're talking farms today, let's use the farm zone. I agree that my land falls within LCDC's definition in Goal 3 of agricultural land, which shouldn't be surprising since once we get outside of cities, 97% of all the land's in farm and forest zones. So I agree that my land fits within that definition, but I want to take an exception to that goal, and I have some reason, and there's three types of exceptions. One is a built exception. I believe that because of the development that's already occurring on my parcel, that it no longer can be used for agricultural purposes, even though it fits within the definition of agricultural land. The second type of exception is a committed exception, where the landowner makes the argument, yeah, my land falls within the definition of agricultural land, but the uses going on around my property are such that my property can no longer be put to agricultural use, and therefore it should be rezoned to something else, industrial, rural, residential, whatever. And then the third type of exception is the reasons exception, and that's what this bill is trying to get at. And it's the idea that it's sort of a catch-all exception. No, my land's not built up to the point where it can't be used for whatever its intended purpose is. Or no, the area surrounding mine property isn't committed to another type of use, but there are some other reason. So continuing on with our farm example, a good example of a reasons exception would be, well, yeah, my land falls within the definition of agricultural land. No, there's no buildings on it, and no, the uses surround nobody. You know, it's open space surrounding my land. But gee, I can't farm my land because the soils are bad. It's never been farmed. It can't grow trees. It's not farmland. You would take, even though it falls within the definition, folks understand. You and I could all go out, and I could take you to all kinds of different areas of this state where the land is zoned for farmland, and we all agree it isn't. And so a reasons exception would be based on the idea, well, yeah, my land falls within LCDC's definition, but it isn't ag land. So you'd be asking for a reasons exception at that point, but in the 23 years that LUBA has been in existence, the Land Use Board of Appeals, they have never affirmed a local government's reasons exception. So basically, you have it in statute, but I don't think there's a way to qualify for it. Now, what this bill does is it just removes one of the four criteria, and that criteria is that there are areas which do not require a new exception cannot reasonably accommodate the use. The idea being, if my property qualifies for an exception, a reasons exception for some particular purpose, why should it matter that there's property over here that's been correctly zoned? Under the current law, you have to demonstrate not only that your property there's some reason why your property should be rezoned, but also that the county that there's no other areas around that could make, you know, that where the same use could be made, which doesn't make any sense, because if your property's miszoned, what difference does it make if the property over here has been properly zoned? That's what 2860 is designed to do. It won't make wholesale changes. I can't tell you for sure whether it will result in LUBA actually affirming a reasons exception. They've had over 20 years and haven't managed to do it yet. I'm not blaming LUBA,
Again, it's the mind-numbing detail, both in the statute, but particularly in the administrative rule, that's resulting in the inability to get a reasons exception. But if we're going to have this debate and we're going to talk about, and you're going to hear people saying, well, if land is miszoned, then they can qualify for an exception, then let's try and make sure that that's true, and that's what this bill does.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have a couple minutes for our final panel of Harlan Levy, Mike Kohlmeyer, and Ron Ebert. If I could have all three come up. If you would be brief with your comments, I would appreciate that.
Good morning, Representative Chair Garrard, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, staff attorney with the Oregon Association of Realtors. We support this bill. The exceptions process is broken. It is very difficult, if not impossible, to achieve an exception. The whole purpose of the exceptions process was to provide a safety valve for land that was miszoned within the statewide land use system. A couple of quick examples of how broken the system is. You have ODOT sponsoring legislation to try to basically have the legislature give it an exception to Goal 18 along the coast. You have local governments that are jurisdictions along the coast also seeking the same exception to Goal 18, because it is nearly impossible and very cost prohibitive for them to go through the regular exceptions process as it is currently written. We think this bill is a step in the right direction, and we would urge that you support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Levy. Mr. Kohlmeyer.
Chair Garrard, members of the committee, my name is Mike Kohlmeyer, and this testimony is submitted on behalf of 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I have submitted written testimony for the record, and in the interest of time, I will briefly summarize portions of that testimony. 1,000 Friends of Oregon strongly opposes House Bill 2860 because it violates in a very fundamental and harmful manner, basic principles of the Oregon Land Use Planning Program. One basic tenet of land use planning in Oregon, and one that all parties can support, is that necessary development should be accommodated and farm and forest land and other resources should be protected. The win-win situation in Oregon land use occurs when development and conservation can both be satisfied at the same time. House Bill 2860 is particularly harmful and, in our opinion, unnecessary because it kicks in only in a situation when such a win-win situation would otherwise be achieved, and then is applied in that situation in a manner that basically takes that win-win situation off the table and prohibits consideration of it during the reasons exception process. The adverse consequences of this legislative proposal were both obvious and dramatic. It is obvious that taking potential win-win alternatives off the table is poor public policy, yet that is exactly what House Bill 2860 would do. You should not require by law such an inappropriate public policy result. We strongly urge you not to support House Bill 2860, and it is our contention that the exception process is not broken, that it is not intended to be easy to take an exception to the statewide planning goals. The goals are important. They provide protection to important values, and therefore it should not be easy to take an exception, but the exception process does provide the flexibility that is necessary to allow both conservation and development to be accommodated. 1,000 Friends of Oregon appreciates the opportunity to provide testimony on this bill.
Mr. Eber.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Eber, Department of Land Conservation and Development. I would simply point out our concerns with the bill that it does two things. It not only has the language prohibiting us to have any rules that would have an exception be denied on the basis of an alternative areas analysis, but it also takes out the statutory standard. Unfortunately, I was unable to make copies this morning. This bill and this law was put in effect in 1983 and was a major revision from the exceptions process as it was before, and it specifically changed the previous analysis that required a look at specific alternative sites to the area being proposed for an exception and made it a much more general areas analysis. There was a specific intent statement that went along with this that was prepared by then Governor Attia's office that was in the record, And the language in there that all the parties had agreed to with how the alternative analysis would go forward is what is in our rule at the current time. It simply requires that people, in making the case for the exception, look to see if there were alternative areas more appropriately planned and zoned for that use rather than going out into farm and forest zones. One other comment, Mr. Chair. The department can provide you with numbers. Many reasons exceptions have been adopted by local government and approved and taken effect around the state. We could provide you with numbers specifying what those are and where those are and exactly when they were approved. With that, I'll be brief.
Any questions of the panel? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, just to the panel. We don't have the rules before us, but do I assume from your testimonies that the suitability factor is embodied in some administrative rule right now?
Chair Girard, Representative Ackerman, you meaning the suitability of the land for farm or forest purposes or the suitability of the land for the proposed use?
Well, for the exception process as stated in this bill. I'm looking at the bold language at the bottom of page one, where I believe the bill would restrict the ability of the commission to develop rules regarding the suitability of the area.
Okay. Chair Girard, Representative Ackerman. Yes, the rules that were developed by the commission specifying the types of reasons that would be appropriate for an exception get to and address the question, ask the applicant to address why that site is appropriate, why that use is appropriate in that area rather than some other area. There might be a site-specific reason, certain infrastructure that's there. It might be a resource-dependent use that really needs that site. So that is specified in the rules. And I would be more than glad to get you a copy of those exception rules if you would like.
Yeah, I'm trying to see how this works. Are you saying then that the suitability factor, as you described it, is only one element in the exception? And to justify an exception, it's not a per se rule where it stands alone to deny or allow an exception?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman. That's correct. The rules follow the format that's above in the bill under specifying the reasons for the exception, how they look at alternative areas, what the consequences of that use being proposed in that area would be, and whether it's compatible with adjacent uses. So the rules follow and only can interpret what the four factors are that are in the statute.
Okay. I think it would be helpful to look at those rules because I think that's what this bill is getting at, Mr. Chair. So I'll make that just as a staff request.
Very good.
Thank you.
Our staff has disappeared on us.
Well, he's there he is. Going to get the rules.
When we bring this back, Representative Ackerman, we will make sure that we have copies prior to.
Mr. Chair, could you repeat that? I didn't.
Representative Ackerman wanted to have the rules that are applicable to this bill made available to the committee prior to any further public hearing.
Shall be done, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, John.
I'll provide a copy of the rules to Mr. Kelly and the memos from 1983.
Very good. Thank you, Ron.
You're welcome.
Appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
So we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2860, and I'm going to open a quick public hearing on House Bill 2912, simply to announce that this bill will be amended. And Representative Ackerman, did you want to make an announcement in regard to this bill?
Yes, I had an inquiry from the governor's office, and their staff person wanted to be here today at the public hearing, and I would like to request to accommodate the governor's office that the public hearing be continued until a week from Thursday so they can make their appearance. I understand they have small technical amendments and they are in support of the bill.
Good. We will schedule the bill then for a week from Thursday, or a week from, yeah. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2912 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3175. Mr. Administrator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3175 directs the Department of Environmental Quality to identify pending and expired permits
that affect the Willamette River Basin water quality. It directs the department to address through permits discharge of toxins, metals, and other pollutants for which the Willamette River exceeds federal standards. It creates a small business and municipality technical assistance account, places a portion of water quality penalties into the account, uses money in the account to assist small businesses and municipalities in complying with water pollution standards. It modifies the green permit program, extends the sunset of issuance of permits to January 2nd, 2008, directs the department to seek federal funding for reducing mercury hazards from abandoned mines, directs the department to report to the Legislative Assembly on a yearly basis, declares an emergency effective on passage. Mr. Chair, this bill comes to us from the House Majority Leader, who is here to go ahead and introduce and testify on the bill.
Happy to welcome Representative Knope from the good area of Bend. Good morning, Tim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. House Bill 3175 came out of Legislative Council about 5 minutes before the filing deadline, and I would have liked to go around and collect more support for the bill, but unfortunately the time crunch didn't allow me to do that. But I would like to say at the outset that I really believe that we need to have balance between regulation and our environment and business protection. And with the drafting of this bill, we attempted to get there. Don't believe the bill overreaches, and I know some would like to add things to this, but what we're attempting to do is obviously get at a significant issue with the Willamette River Basin and the issue of mercury as it relates to mines, recognizing that this is going to be a very tough budget year for a lot of the natural resource agencies, and the fact that there may be some money available at the federal level as it relates to abandoned mines and the mercury issue, mainly in rural Oregon and mostly on federal lands. So Representative Bates and myself have authored letters to our congressional delegation from Congressman Walden, Senator Smith, and Wyden, requesting their help on that particular issue and element of this bill. But basically what this bill does is it focuses in on the green permitting process, and not a process that I've been a part of, but something that I think would be helpful to make sure that we identify. But basically what it does is it requires that the DEQ identify all these permits that are pending and expired on the Willamette River Basin, and the agency needs to develop a timetable for reviewing and reissuing those permits that are important to some businesses that have those along the Willamette River area. And those permits that are issued by December 31st, 2005, those permits that are issued upon renewal address to the greatest extent possible the discharge of all toxins, metals, and other contaminants for which the Willamette River does not comply with federal standards or the Clean Water Act. And it creates a small business and municipality technical assistance account, and that account would be separate from the general fund. It directs that some money from penalties go into that. It also authorizes DEQ to use money from that account to assist small businesses and municipalities in complying with water pollution standards through the purchase of private technical assistance. And small municipalities may also use the money to reduce urban runoff and household hazards. And even though they may be small, they may have a little bit of urban in them. So we want to make sure that they're able to use that money for that purpose. And this bill also will extend the sunset of the green permitting process out to January 2008, and currently it's set to expire in 2004. And again, I think what we're trying to do is encourage a cooperative process here. I know there are folks who will come behind me to testify on this bill, and I just would like to indicate that I'm open to amendments on this bill that doesn't loaded up to the point where we can't pass it just because of the financial burden that it might create on an agency. And we're trying to be as responsible as possible. And I know the ag community has some interest in some amendments, and I know DEQ has expressed that they have some amendments that they might want to. Most of them sound technical in nature, and I think it would be wise to have a group sit down and go over those and see if we can't come to some resolution before you just, you know, work session this bill. So with that, I'm happy to answer questions that I can to the Graham Abel and to have other folks come up and testify in regards to their interest in the bill.
Any questions of Representative Knopf?
Seeing none, thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I appreciate the time and attention to the bill.
Stephanie Halleck, Director of Department of Environmental Quality. Good morning, Ms. Halleck.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Stephanie Halleck, the Director of the Department of Environmental Quality, and with me today is Greg Aldrich, who is in our water quality program and is in charge of making sure that we do all these TMDLs throughout the state and on the Willamette. I want to thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to be here today, and especially at a time certain, which was extremely helpful in my schedule, and I appreciate it. And I also want to thank Representative Knopf for sponsoring House Bill 3175 and for the committee for hearing the bill today. Obviously, we've been hearing a lot of talk this session about, and rightly so, about economic development and the need for jobs in Oregon, and I'm glad that we are getting a chance to talk today a little bit about some of the environmental issues on the Willamette River, which is a very important part of our work at DEQ, as well as to others in the state. And we've done a lot of work on the Willamette, I don't have to tell you, since the early 1900s, when it was basically an open sewer, and a lot of cities and a lot of businesses have spent a lot of money to do cleanup. And I've given you a fact sheet attached to my testimony that outlines some of the issues that we're looking at today on the Willamette. So as you heard from Representative Knopf, there's a number of elements in this bill and good ideas for how to tackle some of the problems. Our particular piece is working on setting on the what we call the total maximum daily loads, or TMDLs, that basically tells us how much pollution needs to be reduced for the river to meet clean water standards. Completion, we're operating under a consent agreement with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and some litigants that has a schedule for completing all of the TMDLs statewide, and the Willamette is in that schedule for completion by the end of this year, which is dependent upon a policy package that is currently under consideration in Ways and Means. Specifically, as you heard from Representative Knopf, House Bill 3175 would continue the work on the Willamette with some new ideas as well, in addition to having us identify the permits that need to be worked on and having a schedule for getting those completed. There would be a grant program created, as you heard. There would also be prioritization of enforcement of water quality problems on the river, an expansion and continuation of the green permits program, and also cleanup of abandoned mines, which is a problem for, as a source of mercury, particularly in the head up toward the headwaters of the river. I do need to point out that while we support this bill, it does have it does contemplate a general fund appropriation, and that we would need some additional funding to implement several sections of the bill, and that that funding is not in the governor's balanced budget. But we're certainly happy to be part of any work group that Representative Knopf is, or the committee would like to have address some of the issues in the bill. We have provided some technical language to the staff, and so I think some of those discussions are ongoing already, and we look forward to working with everyone, and again, thank you for hearing the bill today.
Any questions of Director Halleck? Seeing none?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Catherine Vanetta.
Chair, members of the committee, Catherine Venata representing the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association, a trade association that represents a majority of the pulp and paper mills in the Northwest, including six mills that hold NPDES permits in the Willamette Basin. NWPPA was formed in the 40s to actually originally help the mills work on cleaning up the Willamette River, and currently we're a regional trade association. NWPPA supports the concepts behind 3175 and supports technical amendments to help improve the goals of the bill. We would ask that we would be included in any work group that would be appointed to work on this bill, because we do have a large interest as permit holders on the Willamette. NWPPA works on public policy forums on clean water, including the Willamette TMDL Council, where we are funding temperature studies to help the department set the TMDL on temperature for the Willamette. We also participate in the Blue Ribbon Committee, sponsored by the DEQ, to work on the wastewater permitting program, where we are currently examining the backlog of permits and program funding. And just so you know, we're using lots of paper on this process. This is the notebook the department has provided the stakeholders to work on that issue, and we've already held two meetings on that issue. A note that I would like to put on the record is that NPDES permits that have been administratively extended must still meet all applicable regulations and any new requirements. Specifically for the pulp and paper industry, this means that craft pulp mills located on the Willamette meet all the federal cluster rule requirements for best management practices and monitoring, even though those permits might have been administratively extended since those federal regulations came into effect. The NWPPA does support the Green Permit Program. When that program was brought forth in 1997, we were a sponsor of the bill. I personally worked on that and worked on the reissuance of that, well, the extension of that program since 1997. Overall, NWPPA supports funding for the DEQ work on TMDLs, which is testified down in the DEQ budget committee on that, in front of the Natural Resources Sub of Ways and Means. We also believe in funding for the implementation of TMDLs through permits. We believe in work on green permits and technical assistance for smaller municipalities and small businesses that could actually have a great impact on improving water quality in Willamette. Thank you, and once again, I would like to be included in any work group to work on this issue.
Any questions of Ms. Venata? Seeing none, thank you. And our final testimony on this bill is Matt Blevin. Good morning, Matt.
Morning, Chair Gerard, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Matt Blevins, Legislative Affairs Director with the Oregon Environmental Council. Thanks for the opportunity to testify on this bill. OEC supports House Bill 3175 as a move in the right direction to clean up the Willamette River. As the public well knows, the Willamette River is polluted. For example, the entire main stem of the river is so polluted with mercury that it's unsafe to eat many of the types of fish from the river. Nonetheless, if you look carefully at air and water permits issued to industries discharging mercury and other toxic chemicals in and around the river, almost none of those permits actually include limits on these toxins. So this bill would require that all water quality permits issued to dischargers to the Willamette River incorporate limits for heavy metals like mercury and other toxins that are causing exceedances of federal water quality standards. Taking steps to reduce the discharge of heavy metals and other toxic pollutants will certainly help to clean up the river and protect public health from the dangers associated with these chemicals. Yeah. The committee should keep in mind that some sources of water pollution are not caused directly by the discharge of contaminants to the water. For example, when mercury is released to the air, as it is by several point sources in Oregon, ultimately that mercury ends up in water somewhere, sometimes adding significantly to the total load of that pollutant in the water and in the fish. As a result, we would strongly recommend that the committee consider adding a provision to this bill that would ensure that sources of those contaminants that emit the pollutants to the air but ultimately impact water should also have to have permits covering those discharges. We'd also like to point out that there are many other rivers in Oregon that are experiencing pollution problems. And as a point of fact, 700 miles of waterway are so contaminated with mercury that the fish are unsafe to eat. In addition, about 60% of major and 47% of minor water pollution permits in Oregon are now expired. This bill would require DEQ to develop a timetable for reviewing and reissuing those permits in the Willamette River Basin. Many of Oregon's expired water pollution permits are not in the Willamette River Basin. While we agree that preventing more pollution in the Willamette River is critical, we encourage the committee members to consider applying provisions of this bill to the whole state so that all Oregonians will be able to enjoy clean rivers in their communities. This bill would also fund these efforts via the State General Fund. We would encourage the committee to consider other sources of funding since general fund dollars obviously are in short supply this session. For example, SB 845 would require the water pollution permitting program to be 100% self-supported through fees. It's only fair for those that contribute to Oregon's pollution problem to pay the costs associated with regulating those discharges. We strongly support the concept of maximizing incentives for permit holders to minimize the discharge of pollutants. In the current bill, this language is only associated with the Green Permit Program. We would also encourage the committee to consider associating this language with all permits. We strongly support providing technical assistance to small businesses and municipalities. Given the complexity of the law, permit holders, especially small permit holders, do not always fully understand their compliance responsibilities. Providing technical assistance will help small businesses and municipalities understand and comply with the law. Technical assistance will be provided by private sector businesses, thus strengthening Oregon's homegrown economy. We agree with the principle laid out in the bill that the pollution fine should be used to prevent pollution. Using penalties paid by permit holders to support technical assistance is consistent with other state agencies. For example, Oregon's Occupational Safety and Health Administration deposits penalties into a grant fund for businesses for employee training. The Oregon Department of Agricultural penalties are used by the agency for the administration and enforcement of quarantine laws. We'd encourage the committee to consider increasing the amount of recovered penalties that can be deposited in a small business and municipal technical assistance account. More resources available to support technical assistance will mean more business in compliance with their permit and therefore less pollution. We also support the DEQ seeking out and employing all means to secure federal funds for abandoned mine cleanup. However, there are many abandoned mines in the state that are not on federal land, and that will require additional state funds to cover the cleanup costs. Senate Bill 817 would also allow DEQ to clean up abandoned mines on state land where the federal government is not participating in the cleanup. So obviously, we think this is a good idea. We're encouraged that Representative Knope has offered this, and I hope the committee will move forward on this. We also would be very interested in being part of any work group to hammer out any amendments to this, and would encourage the committee to consider some of the suggestions we've made. Thanks.
Any questions of Mr. Blevins? Seeing none, thank you, Matt. I think the chair has heard testimony that would recommend that we do form a work group in regards to House Bill 3175, and I will appoint or ask those that spoke today on this bill to be on that work group, and I would ask Director Halleck to chair that group, if she would, and report back to this committee on or about April 10th to that effect, and we'll look forward to seeing what the work group can develop on this bill. And I will close the public testimony or public hearing on 3175, and I'm just going to committee just tap House Bill 3120 in, and we if we bring it back, it'll be for public testimony and have plenty of opportunity, but we've run out of time this morning. So I'll open a work session on House Bill 3120 and then close the work session on House Bill 3120 and adjourn the House Committee on Environment and Land Use at 10:28.